And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is G Captain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of G Captain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles, and in the studio with me is John Conrad. We are your hosts. Welcome, John. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Good to see you. This broadcast is for the week of April 14th, 2014. Listeners, this is the place we bring you the latest news and happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. Today, we'll be talking about a couple of things. First off, we have to review the week of festivities for birthdays. And I found out something else about a birthday that is significant here, and we'll talk about that. And then just a quick little follow-up. Last week, we spoke about being rescued at sea and how to find objects at sea and how to get things in the middle of the ocean out of the water. And there was a big news story that came out so directly related to that, so our timing was very good. And then our main topic today is going to be on ship design. There has been some innovations in ship design over the years, and we'll talk about the effects of that, the consequences of that, and the implications. And we'll see if the industry is getting greener, perhaps, as the years go by. So first off, John, last week, as you know, we announced that this week was going to be my 50th birthday week. So yesterday I did in fact turn 50. I made it to the half century mark.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I will say too that I got several nice emails from
some
listeners.
Some good advice too.
Some great advice. So I went into it, I think I shared with you and the listeners last week, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was struggling mentally with the issue. I was grappling with the issue of turning 50. And I got to the point where I realized it was all attitude, and even furthermore, to the point of looking forward to it. And yesterday, I just had a fantastic birthday. My birthday is April 9th, which I found out also is somebody that you know, their birthday as well.
Yes, my son, Jack.
Your son, yeah. So I invited John to lunch yesterday for the birthday, for part of the birthday celebration that I'm having, and he said, well, I can't do it today. I'm having father-son birthday celebrations over here, so happy birthday to Jack as well.
We had fun, went down to the Avila Hot Springs. It's a natural sulfur spring pool with some water slides, and it's a good time.
Very good. Well, that's cool. And at the restaurant, I went and had some sushi last night with my kids, and there were two other people in there that actually had their birthdays on April 9th. So, and I know also Hugh Hefner, the publisher and inventor of Playboy, he celebrated his birthday on April 9th and has for several years now. So it's good to be 50. Thank you, listeners, for the advice. I've embraced my maturity, shall we say, and I'm having fun with it. So I'm looking forward to a great decade, and that was the advice that was given to me, and I guess at the end of the day, it all comes down to attitude. I'm in good health. I'm having fun. So again, thank you, listeners.
I'm sure Hugh has some good advice on living life to the fullest after 50. I'm sure he has a book out or some advice on how to do that. He seems to live life pretty well.
And I think he's the kind of guy who's really led by example.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I used to live in the Los Angeles area. And back when I was a highfalutin stockbroker, I ran in some pretty highfalutin circles. But one thing that I've never done, John, is I've never been to that Playboy mansion. Have you ever been there?
I have a hookup. I get invited every year. I haven't gone. But I can pass the invitation your way if you are interested.
You get an invitation every year?
Yes.
John, we're going to be speaking after this broadcast.
Absolutely.
I was hoping to do that before I turned 50, but just as the listeners and my good buddies who've already turned 50 told me, hey, 50 to 60, that's the time to really tear it up in life. So who knows, listeners, we may have an interesting report from the Playboy Mansion for you sometime soon. Now, John, we spoke last week about finding things in the middle of the ocean, rescuing objects or people from the middle of the ocean and the challenges that come with that. And I think it was just a day or two later, there was a big news item that came out about a sailboat that I think, and I didn't really read any of the articles, so you'll have to help me out on this. I know that they had a very sick child, and I believe they were off the coast of Baja California in the Pacific Ocean, maybe a couple hundred miles, and that somebody went and had to pick up this child. What happened?
Yeah, this 36-foot boat. This family went out on a 36-foot boat for a round-the-world cruise. Father, wife, and two small kids. A one-year-old daughter and a three-year-old daughter. And they had some problems before they left. There aren't too many people who sail with their whole families at a young age. Our kids are a little older than this. My daughter just turned 6 and my son turned 8 years old yesterday. So they're a little bit older, but it's a question we've had. We have a sailboat, it's 42 feet. It's built really strong. There's not much air. You're either in the harbor of Morro Bay or out in the Pacific. So even for a day cruise, you really need an ocean-going vessel. And my boat was really built stout. I would feel comfortable sailing myself around the world with it, absolutely. And it's led to the question, hey, should we take off? Every time we go out for a day sail, I tell my wife, hey, we can turn to port and head to Hawaii or turn to starboard and head home. And she's always chosen to go home, unfortunately. I've always had, I miss the sea. I haven't been back to sea in 2 years, doing GCAP full time now. And then it gets in your blood and love to do it. But that's the question, is the children, because you get out beyond helicopter range, and it's going to take a considerable amount of time if something goes wrong for the Coast Guard, the Navy, or a merchant ship to come save you. And this family had some problems before. They had a case of salmonella poisoning. Now, it's a small, there aren't too many people who go on these boats with their families, but a lot of them blog, and my wife actually follows all of these blogs. I think Zach on Board is her favorite. And this family has a blog that she's followed, and she said there was salmonella poisoning on board, and they think they traced it back to the diapers. She was washing the diapers in the sink, which...
Oh, boy.
We don't know their level of experience, but anyone who's been out to sea, the best way, when you get your coveralls covered in dirt, you put them in a mesh bag, throw them overboard, let them drag for a few hours, and that's the way to...
Yep.
Clean diapers, but on a boat it's confined, and those problems you see with the cruise ships all the time, they have those sickness problems. You really have to keep things very clean and meticulous and separated, and we don't know exactly what happened, but the one-year-old developed a fever and a rash, and she was already on antibiotics for the salmonella, and they called the Coast Guard who coordinated with the Navy and rescued the family. But it's been a big news story all over, and people asking, was this a smart move of the family to travel that far with kids?
Well, a couple of things stuck out in my mind. One, if children on boats, scary to me for two reasons, particularly if you're going to be in blue water. One is just keeping an eye on the little buggers. I would think that I would want to have the kid tethered, a kid younger than, say, 6 years old or younger, tethered the entire time with some type of safety line on him. That would be the first big concern of mine. The second would be illness. I would want to either myself have a high level of medical preparedness or have somebody on board who was paramedic, basically somebody that could attend to any type of sickness in a child. And I suppose in general, I guess being out at sea, and you've been out at sea, typically there's somebody on board that has medical experience and certain certifications that you need as well for crew members on board. So those are the two things that would really scare me about having a child out at sea. Now, the other thing that I did, because
not only the training, but we have a whole hospital on board ships with a few hundred different medications, all the antibiotics, all the painkillers, we carry them all on board with a defibrillator and other stuff.
Which a recreational boater probably would not have.
No, there's no room for that amount on a 36-foot boat. There was a lot of criticism on the GCaptain article that we posted. The one that really resonated with me was sailing, especially in a small vessel across the ocean. It's not that difficult to learn and to figure out what to do and plot the course. And there's nothing really difficult about it, but it's probably the most challenging thing you can do as an individual. And the reason why is, what's important at sea is that maintain a level of energy. You told me a comment a few weeks ago about, the most valuable asset in business was enthusiasm. And I'd say that's almost the same on a ship or a boat, but it's energy too, because when you hit bad weather, and it doesn't even have to be horrible weather, just, you know, 10-foot seas and 20, 30 knots of wind, it just wears down your energy. And you start, what happens when you get tired is you stop taking the extra step. So when I'm wide awake and I'm watching, I might be in the middle of the ocean, see a contact, I'll go up, I'll check the radar, I'll check the ACTS, I might call on the VHF, maybe out of just boredom, I want to talk to someone else. Mm-hmm. But when you're tired, you say, oh, he's okay, and you know, it's only one contact. It's pretty hard to hit one individual object at sea. We'll be okay, and 99 times out of 100, you are right. But that one time, you need that energy, you would have found something. So it's when you're sleep deprived and operating a small boat like this, I would imagine they have watches throughout the night, you know, it really drains the energy.
Right.
And the comment on G Captain is there is nothing in the world that drains your energy like sailing a 36-foot boat across the ocean, except taking care of a one-year-old.
Right. Which I've got twins myself. They're older now. They're 10 years old, but I would attest to that fact. How old was this child on board the sailboat?
One.
And was it a he or a she?
She.
So she was just one year old. Well, you know, I tell you, I wasn't very critical before of the fact that they were taking their child out. A one-year-old... you know, I'd have to give that maybe a little bit more thought. I suppose it's okay. I don't know. I don't think I'd want to myself. I'd have to give it more thought to really determine if that was a prudent thing or not to do. I suppose it's all right, but who the hell would want to?
I don't know that it is all right. I think, you know, once they hit the age of five, I wouldn't criticize anyone for taking it. It is dangerous. Boom hits them in the head, or they happen to fall overboard. Stuff can happen, and they're probably going to die, and you have to be willing to accept that. But adults probably going to die, too, in that situation.
Right.
And we do underestimate what children can do. I was reporting on a ferry incident in the Philippines a few years back. And these are, you know, they're overcrowded ferries, and one or two of them sinks every year with hundreds of people on board.
Right.
And I was looking at pictures of these ferries, and there are kids just running around, and there aren't safety lines, really, and they're upright on the bow on the edge. And I was talking to a person who lives over there, who specifically investigates marine accidents. Bob Cody has the Marine Accident Casebook, another blog, great blog. He said, well, kids aren't dumb. There is actually more incidents of adults falling overboard because they're drunk or tired than kids falling overboard on these ferries. That kids know to stay away from the edge. So we do have to give them some credit. But I think they'd have to be at least five in order to, you know, be developed enough to stay away from hazards. And I think the main problem that happened here is that energy thing. You know, it was a rash that's usually condition of not good sanitary conditions, and it takes a lot of energy to clean up after a kid and a baby continually. And if you're standing night watches and you're, you know, do you have the energy to sweep and disinfect and do all that extra stuff that you really need to do?
Right. And I think the age, I didn't realize I mean, 1 year old's a baby. It's not a child. It's still a baby. To me, that's almost a little easier to take care of because it eliminates one of those first two things that I mentioned to you. The baby, a one-year-old's not going to be all over the boat. You can kind of secure the baby.
Yes, true.
So I don't know that, and that's why I'm still on the fence with whether or not it's prudent, because you can lash a baby down. You can't really lash down a 3 or a 4 year old because the toddlers are going to be all over the place.
I will say this guy is brave, A, for taking his family out, which is kind of the stupid side of brave. But there's another side of brave, the admirable side of brave, which is his one-year-old was not in immediate distress. And we talked about that last week, how you have to make that tough call way in advance of an actual problem.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that the Navy would give them criticism. Mm-hmm. And this boat was their whole home. They don't have a home. This was their home. Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about rescues, the Coast Guard tends to sink the ships. Because mm-hmm. they're for two reasons. A floating boat is not a is a hazard to navigation. So sure. when they took the family off, they had to sink the boat. The other reason the Coast Guard does is they don't want that particular family going out again, whoever made that case. And they don't always say that, but occasionally you will get a Coast Guardman who will be honest and say, you know, it's kind of, we don't charge for the rescue, but you're going to lose your boat. Well, this guy lost his entire home and everything else, and his daughter might have pulled through it. They go around the phone. They said she might have pulled through without this rescue. And he said, let's go. The father said, we'll make a decision, go through this rescue. So he lost everything, his home, his reputation, he's getting smeared across the media and everything else to save his one-year-old daughter when it wasn't sure she needed saving, but he felt in his gut this was the right thing to do, and he made the call. A lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. A lot of people wait till it's too late, and that would be instead of a story where we're criticizing him, it would be a tragic story.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. So he's having to put up with this new social media world that we live in where everybody's an armchair captain in this case.
But he did come out, and the article we posted today, he visited, they're back in San Diego now. He visited the commander of the Navy ship that saved them and apologized profusely for making them go out of their way to rescue him. But
well, and as you and I talk about often on the air here, is that when you go out to sea, you create some really good stories. So this kid, this little girl, is going to have a story for the rest of her life, won't she?
Yes, and the stories are the dangerous part, because what if they had succeeded? Their blog, they have a lot of readers, a lot of other families who are questioning, should I go, should I not go? If they had gotten there and then say, oh, it really wasn't that bad, it was beautiful, you know, it would have been probably 10 other families that said, well, if they did it with a one-year-old, I can do it with my one-year-old. And that's the problem with a lot of these sailing blogs online. You see these crazy advice that's just not safe. And he goes, I've been across three oceans doing this dumb thing and haven't had one problem. You can do it. You don't need to prepare. You don't need an EPIRB. I've had an EPIRB my whole life. Never used the thing. And people, you know, they say, oh, that guy's been across three times. He knows more than I do. And they follow that advice. But at least this is some advice. And I hope people get that added lesson that, you know, it's a question. Should you go out or should you not go out? But the one lesson to really take away from here is go out if that's what you feel is safe. But be prepared to turn back. Be prepared to call in a rescue before you need it.
Mm-hmm. Preparedness. Excellent. All right. Well, good discussion. Listeners, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back and dive into our main topic of the day, which is ship design and the evolution of ship design. So we'll take a break right now. Stay with us, and we'll hear a word from Six Maritime.
Six Maritime is a leading provider of professional security services for the maritime industry. Using state-of-the-art military and industry practices, Six Maritime provides clients with tailor-made, cost-effective solutions that ensure both safety and security in every environment. Six Maritime specializes in the use of early threat detection technology for both mobile and immobile clients, giving them increased warning time to any threat. Avoid the violence, deter attackers, keep your crew and cargo safe. Leading the next generation of security, logistically simple, technologically advanced. Six Maritime. To learn more, visit sixmaritime.com.
Thank you to Six Maritime for being a sponsor of this show. We appreciate it. So, John, let's talk about ship design. Is there something that's posted on GCaptain currently, an article that prompted this subject for you?
Absolutely. The Wind Challenger is a brand new boat that is using wind to propel. Now, this is not a new idea. We have seen kite ships in the past, but this one specifically has a sail. It looks like a tall ship sail, but the mast is retractable. It's hydraulic, so it goes up and down. This is a joint project between the University of Tokyo and MYK, MOL, K-Line, Oshima Shipbuilding, and Class NK, who are really looking to design the next generation of sailing vessels. Now, this is not a sailing vessel that you picture in your mind. This is a large ship with sails. So we're talking propelling 1,000-foot ships with wind.
Well, and as you mentioned, I mean, this is not a new idea. Obviously, at the beginning of sailing or ocean-faring vessels, this is how they were propelled, I guess, through either oars, manpower, or through wind power. So the difference here, though, is that they're taking things like freighters or tankers and trying to add some efficiencies to them. Is that the main concept?
Yes, this will be very difficult to propel a 1,000-foot ship using wind alone. What they're really looking to do is reduce fuel consumption and reduce carbon emissions and the cost of operating the ship, because the fuel is the largest line item on a ship apart from crew. So that's what they are looking to do, just reduce the amount of fuel they use. It depends highly on the route. So you're going to first see these ships on routes that have a lot of wind, but the wind has to be in the right direction as well. They have the best savings, like a sailboat, when they're heading downwind. And if the wind is head-on, putting up big sails is not going to help you much. So we've seen this before. We saw kite ships was the first really successful use of wind propulsion on large ships. It was Beluga Sky Sails. Now, this is a interesting story and for an American, a little bit of a sad story. Beluga Sky Sails was a ship in promoted by Germany, and they had this enormous kite that is launched from the bow of the ship and pulls the ship along so they can reduce the RPM. Now, this technology was first developed in San Francisco Bay. And when this story came out, I wrote this story in 2010, there was another company that SkySails kind of borrowed the idea and the design from in San Francisco Bay. And I talked to the owner of that company. I don't even remember the name of the company at this time, but that's where it was started in San Francisco Bay. And I said, this European company has it already on a ship, and you've had this technology for 10 years and haven't been able to do anything with it. He goes, well, you have to understand that the European Union, gasoline is very expensive, and a large tax is placed on the gasoline, goes into environmental design. Mm-hmm. So the German company, which had the same technology, was fully funded by the European Union. Now I can feel our Republican listeners saying, well, we can't raise taxes to support this green design. But this guy in San Francisco, his frustration and the sad part of the story is he didn't even want any money from the U.S. government. He said the reason his company, and I talked to him right after his company went bankrupt, or he closed it. So the reason it closed was not the money. It would have been nice to have that millions of dollars of funding. But he says the permits he had to jump through to test this technology in San Francisco Bay were crazy. The government threw up every single obstacle they could imagine. He needed Coast Guard permits and bridge tunnel permits and permits to operate this in. So what's the license you need to operate this boat? And he said, I just want to test this, you know? And he had tugs that were willing to test and stuff, but he could not get the government permits from the city of San Francisco, from the Coast Guard, from the government. He said he could have if he hired 100 employees, but he didn't have the money for that. Mm-hmm. So it was really his frustration, which he wanted us to share with readers, was that, you know, we don't have to, Americans are innovators. They'll find money, they'll find ways, new ways to doing it, things. But the reason we don't have a lot of, you know, a new port hasn't been built in this country in years, and new roads, new railroads, short sea shipping, which is bringing containers from like Port of Long Beach up the coast. Excellent ideas. It's going to provide a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunity. It's not even the monetary aspect of this. It's really that in order to create a new route, build ships, do any of this stuff, you need permits. You need a ton of them. And in Europe, they give you the money and they clear the permit process. And in Japan as well, where this particular ship, this new one, is being designed and built. And in the U.S., we say, oh, you need to fill out this form, that form. You need, OSHA's got to come on board and make sure that you all have your hard hats and everything else. And we just seem like we can't get anything done here.
Yeah. So, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are nodding their heads, as am I right now, too. The regulatory environment and the bureaucratic environment here, after this country being in existence for over a couple hundred years, has become overbearing. So I don't know what the answer is. If we could figure that out, we'd work on curing cancer next. But that is a big challenge, of course, to innovation here in the United States. Well, and I'm always more the type that I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission. So, you know, it's I would hope that these guys could just go out and do some of this stuff.
I mean, people who work on ships, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, will say the amount of paperwork you have to do on a ship now is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. This is a global problem, but it's even worse in the United States. But even apart from that, the drain in energy and productivity, I mean, the last week, I haven't written a good article for GCAP in 2 weeks. Why? Because April 14th is around the corner. Right. I've spent the last 2 weeks, instead of producing great articles and great content for you listeners, I haven't been sitting down doing my taxes. Well, yeah. I don't mind paying. Let me just write a check. And there's so many forms and I don't even know what. I'm a sailor, not a CPA, but
right.
It's frustrating.
And as an economist, that is something that is of great concern, is the drain upon productivity that's created by bureaucracy and overregulation. Well, let's get back to our friendlier issue, which is the design of these vessels. Now, you, if I remember correctly, you've got some flying experience way back when I got my private pilot's license. And for folks that know the theory of flight, it gives them an edge on figuring out how the foil design of a sail works as well. So a lot of people think that the wind pushes a sailboat. Very rarely does it do that. It does do that in some instances, but most often, just the way a plane flies, it's because of the vacuum that's created because of the shape of the sail. But I noticed in the picture that you have on G-Captain, as well as the other example you cited, well, let me go back to the picture that you have on G-Captain. The sails look rectangular to me, although, well, you just pulled up a picture for me, and there is a bit of a foil there. So I don't know if those are true sails, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. I don't know how much you've studied the design. You did mention in the kite design, I mean, that is not a typical sail design, obviously, because that kite is literally pulling the vessel along. It's not working on vacuum or foil, the foil design of a sail. So this vessel that you've got a picture of G-Captain on, are those true sails, or is it actually just catching the wind and actually pushing, is the boat being pushed by the wind?
I think they can go to some angle off the wind, so they don't have to go dead downwind. I think if they're going dead downwind, this flat area is going to catch the wind and it's going to help propel the ship. But they can definitely go at an angle to the wind. They're not going to be able to sail upwind as a sailboat does at a steep angle to the wind. But yes, there is a foil shape design to this. And the biggest problem with this design, you can't use sails on ships. And why? Because what really has to happen is they got to consider the maintenance and the long-term operability of these systems. So we're not going to see lightweight canvas designs and things that could easily tear or rip. I don't know what these particular... Oh, actually, I do. It's retractable fiberglass or aluminum alloy wings that are going to propel this. And you see a lot of the... I believe the world record holder for the fastest sailboat is for a fixed wing design. So this is being used by very high performance sailboats to achieve maximum speed. You could actually do more with this than you can do a traditional cloth sail. But they're using it here both for performance and for maintenance issues. And there is also the problem rivets were used for skyscrapers for years. Do you know why they went from, now all skyscrapers are bolted together with bolts. Do you know why they changed from a rivet to a bolt?
I have no idea.
A rivet has the amount of that same amount of steel, so it's as strong as a screw and bolt. In some instances, it's even stronger, so it's not that the screws are any less effective than the rivet, but a rivet is a thing of art. A guy actually has to stand on a thing and weld this together right on scene. And each rivet has a different, depending on how good that operator was, depends on how good the strength of the rivet is.
Right.
Which is okay, but you can't enter each individual thing into a computer like you can a screw. Screws, you can go down and you could say, go to the construction manager, we need exactly this amount of torque on the bolt, and enter that into the computer. So that's another reason that these hard wings are being used, the aluminum alloy wings versus traditional sail, is because they don't flex as much as a sail. Once you start having flexing in a million directions, that starts getting very complicated for a computer to design, where a fixed wing, you can enter exactly in to the computer, the wind speed, the wind angle, and start coming out with these computational models. And we'll wait to see the first test. They have built the sail and the mast, retractable mast thing, and they have it on land, bolted to, it looks like, a very sturdy concrete foundation, and they're testing it right now, but we'll have to wait to see when the actual ship's built and this is operating on the ship, how much savings there will be.
Now, here's the question, John. This is a big, I'm going to open up a big, what potentially could be a big topic here, or a big area that we could explore. We only have 5-7 or so minutes left, so we'll dive into this a little bit. But we're talking about innovation here with regard to ships and making them, A, more efficient, but then also B, at the same time, more environmentally friendly. Because if, for instance, a ship is able to use wind power at a significantly higher level and petroleum-based fuels at a lower level, then it's argued that the wind obviously is a renewable fuel, a source of energy, and it's much kinder to the environment. So should the ship industry, the shipping industry, be driven here by profits, in other words, the efficiency factor, or should they be driven by the green considerations, the fact that this is making the world a better place by having more environmentally friendly ways of transporting goods?
You're going to get me in trouble with my answer.
That's why I asked
it. It's a bit of the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain and what's actually going on here. But
okay. Well, I'm glad I asked it then.
Environmental issues are the top issues right now. You go to a major shipping conference and it's all about shipping efficiency. And it's all green and we want to save the environment. That is not what is driving this innovation. What is driving this innovation is the price of fuel has quadrupled. When I was sailing a super tanker up to Valdez, we had 1 million barrels of oil on board. And I remember it was $17 a barrel.
Yeah.
And if I had made a navigation mistake, there goes $17 million. And I thought I was impressive. Now that same tanker is, I don't know what the price of oil is at this moment.
Yeah, about $102 or so.
$102. So it's significantly higher. So any savings they can, ship owners can do, it's all about saving fuel, saving the bottom line. Ship owners are cheap. They have to operate. They operate on razor thin margins. They have to save every penny they want. They will take any design that saves them costs. And anything related to fuel nowadays, with the price of fuel where it is saving cost. That says you will not see the transparent honesty. You will not get that answer from the ship owners. What will the ship owners say? Ships are already the best, most efficient models out there, but we can make them a little better. Why do they say that? They're not saying that in order to get your support or your vote or you're doing anything else. They're saying that because that is what they need. They need to tear through these bureaucracies. They need the port approvals. And the politicians love hearing environmental issues. So the shipping industry is pushing its green nature. It's pushing its green nature in order to get the approvals passed.
And don't you think subsidies? I thought you were going to go more toward the subsidy issue as opposed to the approval process. I'm sure it helps fast track some of the approval and permitting requirements. But I think the real pot of gold at the end of the rainbow would be the example that you cited over in Europe, the ability to get subsidy dollars to help out.
This particular ship is being sponsored by the University of Tokyo. If you went to the University of Tokyo and said, I want to shave ship owners X amount of millions of dollars a year, they said, what good is that? We don't care much about ship owners. But if you go to the University of Tokyo and say, we want to prevent 6 million cubic whatevers of CO2 from going into the atmosphere, they'll be on board and they'll say they like it. So you're absolutely right. It's subsidies. Taking a hot knife to bureaucracy. So I don't think it is a little bit of a hypocrisy, but both sides are winning. If we can lower costs and improve the environment, it is a win-win. So I don't necessarily, I was a little hesitant to expose the, just because I don't think it's necessarily bad.
Mm-hmm. So to put you a little further out on the limb here, in the United States, how would you like to see it progress? Because I almost heard you say in there somewhere, John Conrad, that you support these subsidies. Almost. I'm not quite sure that you were saying that, but you were. It almost seemed like you were leaning that way. So how would you, in your opinion, how would you like to see things progress here in the U.S.?
I would like, I've gotten in trouble for this on the GCAP forum too. I think maritime subsidies should be increased by a matter of 2, 4, 10 times their current level. But it doesn't have to increase our overall tax burden. It doesn't have to ruin the nation. Look at the agricultural subsidies. And now I'm going to get in trouble with the, hopefully there aren't any food executives because they're a very powerful lobby. But all I'm saying is, yes, maritime subsidies should be increased dramatically, but only because they are a fraction of what other industries are currently. I think we can lower our overall tax burden and increase the prosperity of this country by making it a little more equal. The fact that farmers are given significantly more subsidies than ships, I'm not saying food is important, but is it more important than being able to ship the food out to get products in, the parts for the tractors and everything else? No. So there has to be, yes, I am for an increase in maritime subsidies.
Okay.
But
listeners, I got him to say it.
It needs to. We don't need to balloon the entire national budget to do. We have to make some cuts in some other areas.
Right. Okay. And those subsidies, of course, would contribute to more efficient ships, which would help the environment at the end of the day as well.
Yes. And not all these subsidies are public. There are a lot of private universities that are studying this stuff too and using private money, and there are other options out there.
And at the end of the day, hopefully as well, just increase the profits of the shipping and maritime industry. That would be the other big positive that we'd see out of that. And we would hope that that would trickle down as well to the people that are listening to this broadcast right now, to the people that are on those ships.
You're pushing me left to the liberal, and you're taking the Ronald Reagan trickle out. You're pushing yourself right. Is this,
yeah,
are we going
you
to
saw,
turn into
you, yeah,
a
you
television
saw,
debate?
You saw the twinkle in my eye. You realized exactly what I was doing. So, all right, John. Well, we are about out of time for this week, and that was a good conversation. I think we veered a little bit from our focus, but it's certainly related to it. It's very interesting. Interesting stuff. So before we sign off, John, closing thoughts with regard to innovation in ship design and ships becoming more efficient.
It's not really about saving fuel or saving the environment. What it is about is just making our industry better. Is there a better way to do things? Is there a way we can build more ships and have those ships operate better? I think the industry needs to step forward, and this is a clear step forward. It's not the only one, but that's what it's really about. Do we want to sit stagnant, or do we want to improve as an industry? I think that's the important thing, you know, that we get better. You teach basketball, you want the basketball team to get better. That's what we want the industry to get better. And this is one of many ways we can do that.
Well said. And I think in this global environment, if we're not getting better, obviously somebody else is. And that means we're moving backwards. This is a case where truly the old axiom that if you're standing still, you're going backwards really does apply. So great. All right, John. Well, thank you very much for those thoughts. And listeners, thank you for being with us. Be sure to tune in next week to keep up with what's going on in the maritime and offshore industry. On behalf of John Conrad and myself, Jeff Eccles, we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Be well and be safe.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. G-Captain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.